Psychotherapy is often used instead of medication in dealing with mental health issues. It doesn't come with a black box warning. It doesn't cause side effects like weight gain, nausea, sexual dysfunction, or sleep disturbance. It doesn't stop working when treatment ends, and it's provided to 20% of Americans every year. But what is it? Stand by, Go Healthy for Good starts right now. Hello and welcome to Go Healthy for Good. Meet Annie, a young mom dealing with a number of health issues. Watch.
I'm Asian, so I eat a lot of rice and more fried food, fried fish, any kind of fried, and more sweets. I guess, yeah, it's so hard with that. I eat chocolates all the time. No exercise at all, even if I have a lot of time. My turning point was that I realized that my back hurts so much, I can't do anything. I realized I wasn't really healthy, especially taking care of my kids. While I was pregnant with my third child, my back hurt so much because I was, of course, overweight, and I couldn't do anything. And being pregnant alone, I don't have my husband with me, I can't even go to the bathroom without any help because of how I gained so much with that pregnancy. I was trying to like limit my food intake. I was just trying to at least cut down my carbohydrates, rice, and that's it until I have my third child. And all my clothes, it's not working at all. So I was like, I think it's time for me to really, really take the step to change.
Time to change, but what to do? On today's show, we talk to a psychotherapist, we'll make some milk without the need of a cow, and learn about an unusual micronutrient. But first, the news. In the headlines today, death rates following psychosis high, negativity linked to heart disease, and expressive writing helps surgical recovery. Research from the National Institute of Mental Health has found young people diagnosed with their first episode of psychosis have 24 times greater risk of death than the general population over the next 12 months. Only people over the age of 70 had similar death rates over a 12-month period. Researchers used data from insurance claims to identify people aged 16 to 30 who had new diagnoses of psychosis, and data from deaths using the Social Security Administration database. So it's not clear how these young people lost their lives. The study also showed 40% did not receive psychotherapy, 60% did not receive antipsychotic medication, highlighting the importance of comprehensive care for this vulnerable group of young adults. Having a negative outlook is a risk factor for heart disease, and women are more likely to have negative emotions than men. Dutch researchers surveyed more than 500 people between the ages of 50 and 70 who had mild heart disease, and another 1,300 with no heart disease. Those with the heart disease were more likely to be anxious, have a negative attitude, and exhibit social inhibition. They were also more likely to say that their health was poor, compared with those without heart disease. So perhaps, ladies, we need to teach ourselves to be optimistic, to trust more and complain less. Expressive writing around the time of surgery may speed wound healing. Previous research showed that writing about a distressing event in the 2 weeks before surgery improved healing. Now, new research from New Zealand suggests that expressive writing after surgery can also be advantageous. 120 healthy volunteers were randomized to write either about a distressing event or how they spent the previous day. They did this either before or after a skin biopsy on their upper arm. The expressive writing group was 6 times more likely to have healed within 10 days of the biopsy than the group that wrote about their previous day. Expressive writing has been found to reduce doctor visits in some studies. The disadvantage is that it can result in a temporary decline in mood before it recovers. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's health news. We attended the EQ Summit at Weimar Institute, which is an open event every year, and we interviewed Amanda Anguish. She's a licensed therapist with Beautiful Minds Medical who practices psychotherapy. I asked her to explain her practice.
Technically, I'm a marriage and family therapist, and people always ask, well, do you have to be married or do you have to be in a family to go to therapy? And I say, well, no, that's just in the state of California where I practice what we have to call ourselves when we're licensed. And so what it means is I work with families and I work with individuals, so you don't have to be in a family or have your own family or be married, but that you're coming to counseling to really understand what you're dealing with. Most people come because of they're not feeling the way they want to feel and they're not acting the way that they want to act. And so I help them figure out why those things are. So psychotherapy is basically helping people figure out why they do what they do and why they feel how they feel.
So who generally administers psychotherapy?
Well, there's three main people that can minister psychotherapy. Actually, in the state of California, if you're a lawyer and if you're a pastor, you can counsel people. But the typical people we think of when we think of psychotherapists are psychiatrists. They mostly deal with medications, but they can also do some therapy. Psychologists do psychotherapy, and then people like myself, marriage and family therapists or counselors, can do psychotherapy.
So is there any advantage to, should people look for a particular one of those, mm-hmm. or is it more about how well that individual delivers the service?
I do think it's important as to who that person feels comfortable with, because some people don't even know what they need when they call, especially the practice that I work in. And so we try to direct them to who might be the most helpful for them. We don't have any psychologists where I practice, but we do have psychiatrists, psychiatric nurse practitioner, and psychiatric physician assistant.
That's great that they mm-hmm. will then get directed and they don't need to make that decision right up front.
Absolutely.
That's perfect. Now, what conditions can benefit from psychotherapy?
The main conditions that benefit from psychotherapy that I tend to work with and most people come with are things like anxiety disorders and mood disorders. And so we tend to call them depression and anxiety, but there is no actual diagnosis of depression. There are many diagnoses that fall into depression, and just like there are many diagnoses that fall into anxiety disorders.
Give us some examples.
Depressive disorders would be, or mood disorders technically, would be things like major depressive disorder, and then you have a bunch of different types that can be mild, moderate, recurrent, things like that. Bipolar disorder, that would be one. Dysthymic disorder, cyclothymia, things like that. Those are tend to be lower grade or more versions of bipolar and major depressive disorder. And then we have the anxiety disorders, which are generalized anxiety disorder.
Would obsessive compulsive disorder?
Yes, obsessive compulsive disorder would be one of those, and also PTSD would be also an anxiety disorder.
So many conditions that it can benefit. More from Amanda in the next segment. Now it's time to think about this.
Hi, honey, I'm home.
Hi, honey. What did you do to my car?
Well, I was driving in the snow and there was all the salt on the road and it just got all over the car. But if you go in and get cleaning materials, I'll wash your car for you.
Really?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, great. Here you go. I got something.
Apple juice to wash the car?
Well, it says freshly pressed apple juice, 100% juice, no added sugar, and it's made in the United States of America.
Don't you know that all the sugar naturally occurring in there is going to make a sticky mess on your car?
Oh, but there's no added sugar.
Well, this is naturally occurring sugar.
Oh.
So you just go back there and get something proper for me.
Okay. Here you go.
Oh, that's much better. Water's much better. But do you think this little bit of water is going to wash this big old car?
Well, we can try.
Oh.
We'll start with the window.
All right.
Okay, you ready?
Some things husbands have to put up with here.
I know. Here. Hey, honey, this looks great now.
I don't think so.
No?
No, come and take a look.
Okay. Oh, you're right.
Now you get in there and you get the right quantity of water for me.
All righty. Will this do?
Oh, that's much better. Much, much better.
Okay.
Thank you for that. Now stand back there.
All right. Many people think that they can drink caffeinated drinks, tea, coffee, and juice all day, and that would be sufficient fluid for them.
Well, you know, the problem with that is that caffeinated drinks actually suck the water out of your system, and the fruit juice has too much sugar, so it'd be much better just to drink plain water.
That's right, and water is a good cleansing agent. Fruit juice, tea, coffee, they're not going to clean you.
And but, you know, the other problem is that thirst is not a good indicator because people don't drink enough if they just go by thirst.
That's right. You need to drink at least a third more, so it's better to drink by volume. And let's say have a bottle and drink several bottles a day or 6 to 8 glasses of water. So here you go. Doctor's orders.
Well, I'll drink to that, Doc. That's mighty good stuff.
Yeah.
You'll like flavored milk, and I hope that you're going to like this one, because this one is a flavored milk with a difference. And Phil's here to help me make it.
Phil, and I am excited about this one because I have never seen anything like this before. So this is going to be a fun recipe.
Yeah,
I know
you've
it already.
You've never made milk with carrots, right?
Absolutely. This is new.
So this is a pumpkin seed milk, which I thought was a milk with a difference. That's why I thought I'd bring it today.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And to make this recipe, we have 1 cup of pumpkin seeds, 3 cups of water, 2 carrots, 1 inch of ginger, 3 to 6 dates, a pinch of salt, a pinch of turmeric, and 1 teaspoon of vanilla. So it sounds like quite a recipe. And I'm, like I said, this is going to be a new endeavor for me. So I'm looking forward to it.
All right. So I'm going to put the water in there. We'll just be adding everything. But what you want to do with your pumpkin seeds is soak them for 8 hours and then strain them through the strainer, and then they're ready to go in. And then we just put everything else in the blender together. But what's interesting is the color that comes out of this milk. So there goes some vanilla essence for flavoring, some lovely antioxidants going in here with the carrots and the turmeric, salt for taste.
Our dates.
Dates for sweetness. Yes.
And then am I correct? We're just throwing the ginger in whole. We don't need to peel it or anything.
Well, you can chop it into 4, say, but you don't need to peel it because you'd be losing some of that nice goodness. And yeah.
So we'll make it a little smaller, easier for the blender.
Easier for the blender.
But that's it.
And that's it. So here we go. And I hope you're going to enjoy this. I'm kind of holding my breath here. All right. That looks like a good vegetable soup, doesn't it?
I was going to say, that's milk, all right.
All right. Why don't you hold our nylon bag?
Okay.
And we're going to sieve this milk through the seed bag. And you ready for me?
I think we're ready.
Okay. Sorry, I'll try not to splash all of the studio with it.
So what we're doing is we're filtering out all the chunks so that what's left is the milk.
Right.
Okay. And we have this little contraption that we've put.
Oh, now don't get it stuck.
Oh, I got it stuck, I think.
There you go. Oh. Well done.
Wow.
Well done. And you can squeeze that out. We probably won't do that because we'll make a big mess here. We'll pop that in there. And then you can actually use this for making soup or as flour. You can even use it as flour.
I was going to say, because I feel like that's a lot of waste unless you use it for another recipe.
Right. And so we would be using that. So you'll squeeze that bag out, but let's try this out on you. Let's see what you think.
Now, what would you use this for? Like cereal? Would you use it just to drink?
Just to drink.
To make maybe in a smoothie even as a base?
Yeah, you could, but it's really just flavored milk. And, you know, sometimes you're caught short, you don't have milk at home and you want to pour something on your cereal, then you could make this.
Well, I think this is a great recipe.
Yeah, yeah. I can see your eyes growing wide at this. Why don't you try it?
I'm going to be the lone person.
Yeah, you're going to be the lone person.
That's really good. That's, yep. I could drink that whole thing, and it's got a little bit of a sweetness to it. But it's nothing, no flavors that are overpowering or anything like that. That's a great alternative to milk. I like it.
Surprised, weren't you?
Yeah, very. This is quite a recipe. This is good.
Remember, you can find our recipes on the website hopetv.org/gohealthy. Annie was onto her third pregnancy and had rapid weight gain. With being both heavy and pregnant, her back was so painful she was unable to care for herself, let alone her children and the brand new baby. Watch what happens next.
First of all, I don't know how to cook. And every day before, every day was a struggle for me and how to prepare food and how will my kids eat healthier food, and I don't want them to introduce them with the fast food as much as possible, especially going out. I don't want to give them just whatever. At first, I attended the Choice program. The program was so nice because they always teach us to like really prepare, yeah, the simple food, but nutritious ones. What I did was just stay at home that whole week just to make me, you know, make me feel stronger, not to get all those food that I'm craving. I cut down salt, more salt, cut down sugar, cut down. It was so, at first it was so hard for me, so I failed at first. Then I have the determination to really do it. When I really got on my knees, like, Lord, help me, because I'm not healthy inside. I'm so depressed of everything, and I'm always irritable with my kids, you know, screaming here and there because I'm just had a baby and all, and I'm fat. I ask guidance, and then I prepare myself to set my mind to really do it, and so then I prepared more healthier food, green vegetables, more vegetables, more fruits. With my kids, I make it smoothie with them because they don't really take it as that, as salad. So I make spinach, kale, water with it, and fruits, whatever fruits I have in, I incorporated it with exercise every day. For me, I learned that this is just a privilege for us to have this, and God gave us life, and so we have to take care of it. In order for us to take care of our body, in order for us to serve Him well, is to just be healthy inside out and out.
And inside certainly includes our hearts and our minds. We're talking today with psychotherapist Amanda Anguish. I asked her how the relationship between her and her clients influences the success of therapy.
I actually share a lot of times with my clients that sometimes the rapport is made better because a therapist might remind their client of somebody who they have a good relationship with, whether it's the tone of voice, whether it's the demeanor, or something about the look of their therapist. We call that transference. So the relationship that the client and therapist have can be very beneficial or even detrimental based on some of those things. Because imagine if you come to your therapist and your therapist reminds you of the mother that you're trying to deal with right now. That would be very difficult probably. But the therapist can usually recognize some of those things if they're paying attention, and most therapists are trained to pay attention. But also, therapists can have something called countertransference, which means if my client reminds me of somebody I haven't dealt with very well. So all of those things have a play in the relationship. But it's good, even, you know, sometimes those things come up in my therapy sessions. And if we can talk about those things, sometimes it's actually a microcosm of what they're dealing with outside of therapy. So if we can work on those things, it makes it even better for them to be able to take those tools out with them into that relationship.
Fascinating, that mm-hmm. two-way street and all the dynamics.
Absolutely.
Right. Now, one of the techniques I believe that psychotherapists use is psychodynamic therapy.
Mm-hmm.
What is that based on? What is that exactly?
Well, I'll put it simply, I don't study it and practice it, but I do know about it. That comes from Freudian theory of making the unconscious conscious. So when you think of like an iceberg, this is the example that, you know, psychodynamic therapists use. When you think of an iceberg, the part that you actually see is the part on top, and that's much smaller than usually what's underneath the water, which is this big part. So if I ask you what your name is, well, you would tell me what your name is, but before I asked you that, you knew what it was unconsciously, so it was very easy to pull up as soon as I ask you your name consciously. That's when it becomes conscious, because now I'm triggering you to be able to think of that. So psychodynamic therapists spend a lot of time digging underneath the surface and trying to find out all those unconscious things and how they affect you in your conscious life.
So it might be developmental things that happened in your childhood, and they're kind of bringing out the past.
Mm-hmm. But just like, too, what I mentioned earlier about that transference and stuff, that's also something that can be brought up, making the unconscious. So my relationships, if I'm the client, might be based on some of that unconscious stuff. So that stuff in my past where I was treated a certain way or I interacted with people a certain way, and if I notice that that's a pattern in my life, my therapist would be the one to help me see all that unconscious stuff that's happening in my life so that I don't keep developing that pattern over and over again throughout.
Now, I'm thinking, what are the risks of this? Is it possible that you remember things? I know for me, I often remember things a little bit different how the rest of my family remembered that event.
Absolutely.
Is that a risk? Because it's only, there's no one sort of with checks and balances in the room, hopefully, because you're mm-hmm. just one-on-one. Is that a risk?
Absolutely. Some studies show, and they're fascinating studies, that what we remember or what our memories are telling us are actually what we is not so much what happened, but what we remember happening. So one of the things that I find fascinating that goes along with PTSD is back in the day when, you know, there was, you know, war and things like that, the soldiers, as they would come back from battle, would spend a lot of time, you know, on ships or on the slower forms of transportation than we have now today, where you can get on a jet in a couple hours, you're back home from battle. Well, while they were on these ships traveling back from these war-torn countries that they had been fighting in, they would spend a lot of time with their comrades and their brothers, you know, going over what happened. And so one person or one soldier could say something like, yeah, this happened, and I missed our buddy that was there with us. And the others might say something like, well, yeah, we saw what happened, but that's not the way that we saw it when we were there. And so they would spend time going over those memories and being able to work through them. So when they came back, they'd have a much easier time. But what happens if there's nobody there telling you that what you thought you saw isn't actually what you're remembering? It's actually some quite different than what happened.
And so, what are the roots of this therapy?
Well, the roots are basically that there's something really important about what we remember, our unconscious state, and so we have to keep bringing it up. I don't believe that the memory, it's so important to remember what happened, but it's more important to think about, what do I believe about what I think happened? Because what I believe about it is going to affect me a lot more than what actually happened. Because every, you know, you could have two people that went through the same situation and remember it totally differently, and then also believe about that totally differently.
Right. And you can't change what happened, but you can change your belief about what happened.
Yes. Right. And that's absolutely it, is you can't change what happened. We can't go back and fix it, you know, so to say, but we can change how we perceive it.
Let us explain more about that process here.
There's a psychological technique called cognitive reframing, where we identify negative thoughts, feelings, or events, and find a positive way to see the same thing. When Jesus was in the temple teaching a crowd one day, the religious leaders brought a woman who they'd caught sleeping with a man who was not her husband. Adultery, they said, deserves a good stoning. What do you say, Jesus? Jesus said nothing. He just stooped to the ground as if he hadn't heard them and began writing with his finger in the dust. When they couldn't seem to get his attention, they looked at what he was writing. They turned a shade of grey and stalked away. It seemed that Jesus had reframed the event, perhaps by pointing out their sins. He did it unobtrusively and kindly. Once they were gone, he stood up, and still, as though he hadn't heard them, he asked the frightened woman, "Where are those that accused you? Has no one condemned you?" "No man, Lord," she said. Then, for her, he reframed the whole sordid experience. "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." Her fear turned to peace, her shame to joy, and her self-loathing to self-respect. If you want to experience the same forgiveness, if you want to reframe your life, it's free in Jesus.
Trace minerals are minerals that we only need in really small amounts, but that doesn't mean that they're not important. Boron, for example, is a trace mineral that's necessary for many functions in the body. Its most important effect is on bones. Boron has a beneficial effect on calcium utilization. It actually improves calcium laying down on the bone. It also enhances absorption of magnesium. So if you have or are at risk of osteoporosis, then you'll need boron. Another notable action is that boron increases blood levels of cortisol, estrogen, and testosterone, and that may also contribute to its effect on bones. Inflammatory biomarkers drop when people take boron supplements, though it's better to get your boron from fruits and veggies grown in boron-rich soil or from drinking water. Its presence in soil and water varies around the world quite considerably. And it's interesting to see that the rates of osteoarthritis vary according to the presence of boron in soil and water, so that areas with high boron levels have low rates of osteoarthritis, as low as 10%, compared to those areas of the world where boron in the soil and water is very low. A couple of small studies of groups of people with osteoarthritis found that those given boron supplements had a 50% chance of coming off their pain medications, off of their non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. They also had greater mobility and flexibility in their joints. That may be because boron also boosts antioxidant enzyme levels, and that's protective of tissue. Insufficient boron in the diet can contribute to poorer attention and memory. And in areas where boron is high in soil and water, there are lower rates of cancers of the prostate, breast, cervix, lung, and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And boron-containing medications interfere with cancer cell division. It may also limit the adverse effects of certain therapeutic regimes. So, where do we find it? Well, you can tell from here, boron is commonly found in diets abundant in fruits, vegetables, legumes, and nuts. Though the best sources are avocado, followed by peanuts or peanut butter. However, if you decide you want a supplement, most boron supplements are dosed at 3 milligrams, and it's recommended not to exceed 20 milligrams. After all, we use boron to kill critters like ants and cockroaches, so it can be toxic even in humans.
Are you looking for more peace in your life and a better night's sleep? Making changes in your diet and exercise patterns could be the answer. Recently, researchers questioned 2,600 people who had participated in a lifestyle program that focused on healthy food choices and increasing physical exercise. Just 4 weeks later, more than half of these individuals reported sleeping more deeply, feeling less stressed, enjoying emotional stability, and having less fear and depression. A change in lifestyle will improve your well-being, and that's another ageless advantage.
It's question time. Here's our first question. Comes from John. I eat a healthy diet, but I have a benign enlarged prostate. What foods should I eat? A whole food plant-based diet is the best for prostate. Have some pumpkin seeds most days and perhaps consider a good supplement for the prostate that includes saw palmetto. Here's another question. Someone called and asked, I read that bakeware or cookingware with Teflon should not be used because it gives off a gas. Is this true? You're absolutely right. When it comes to Teflon, when it's heated very hot, the gas is quite toxic. It kills birds instantly if they're in the kitchen when a Teflon pan gets too hot and it off gases. There is a development of better, safer, non-stick products all the time by the industry. And so now they're starting to come out with ceramics, and ceramics are thought to be safer than Teflon. Those ceramics are less non-stick. On the other hand, when we have dry cooked food, there is greater production of oxidants and acrylamides, so less frying the better anyway. Here's our last question. Someone texted, I'm vegan, I eat about 90% raw at each meal, I exercise 6 days a week, drink lots of water, but I'm still hypertensive. What else can I do? Well, that's a lot of raw food. What I would say is try adding a half to one cup of well-cooked green leafy veggies to your daily diet and see if that helps. And I say cooked because you get more into your body and more nutrients as well. They're more bioavailable when cooked. Remember, you can send your question in by Facebook, text, phone, or contact us on our website and become part of our Go Healthy for Good Facebook community. Now, let's see what's in the store today.
Bananas are one of the most popular fruit, and they're actually the fifth most important crop in terms of world trade. Since we're always commenting on how the colour of the fruit and veggies indicates their phytochemical power, you might be surprised to know that white bananas have a load of bioactive compounds like phenols, provitamin A, carotenoids, biogenic amines, and phytosterols. Many of these compounds are antioxidants. Along with that, bananas can boost dopamine levels, a neurotransmitter that makes you happy. Historically, both the fruit and the peel have been used to treat a variety of illnesses and to prevent degenerative diseases. They're as good as a sports drink at restoring carbs, potassium, and other nutrients that get burned up during exercise. And the bonus is that they contain antioxidants, resistant starches, lots of vitamin B6 and fiber. They're almost the perfect fruit. Sweet, nice texture, just the right size. They're versatile, affordable, and almost always available. A big plus is that they come pre-packaged. So when I'm traveling in a developed country, I eat a lot because I'm confident that unlike other fruit, these have never been touched by human hands. This thick, easy-to-peel skin protects me from a nasty dose of Dally Belly. Bon appetit.
Today's guest is Amanda Anguish, a licensed counsellor who uses psychotherapy. I asked her about the surge in the use of meditation practices that we see all around us today.
No matter where I look, there's a different definition for it. You can do the very shallow version of meditation. I call it shallow, just because you know, just sitting there and meditating for a few moments can be considered meditation. Or you can get into the stuff where, you know, you have a Zen guru come and who spent 20 years in the practice, and you can spend days and weeks and things like, even months, you know, meditating like the monks do in Tibet and things like that. So our society, when we say meditation, there's a lot of different forms of meditation out there. So it would be very hard for me to define what meditation is, because everywhere you read about it, somebody's calling it something different. It's very general, very popular, versus, no, we're really getting into the religion of meditation. So,
right. So is there a difference between meditation and mindfulness, or are they just terms that refer to the same
thing? They're very similar terms. We as Christians, when we think of meditation, or what I would hope we would think of meditation, is actually meditating on something, you know, meditating on the life of Christ, meditating on the things that we're grateful for that Christ has done in our lives. But then there's also the form of meditation that the world tends to think more about in mindfulness, where it's either on a thought where we're processing something that we've been through, or it's the meditation of getting rid of all thoughts and just being in a place of sort of emptiness, or this nebulous place where nothing is, and just focusing on that. Or I've even seen studies where somebody focuses on their finger.
Right.
Yes, for a very long period of time.
Oh, I would get so bored. But then there would also be the mantra, or does the mantra come into this sort of empty place? So it's, mm-hmm. in a way, you're focusing on sounds in your head or sounds that you're making.
Yeah, and when people are meditating, oftentimes what people are trying to get away from are heavy thoughts, the negative thoughts that they have, or the chaos in their life. And so they do these forms of mindfulness and meditation to get away from those things. And so, yeah, that can change the brain and how it responds to those types of things in their life. I like to think that there are other things that we can do to sort of get to the root cause of why we're seeking out meditation versus just trying to get help and put a Band-Aid on it.
So that brings us to the style of psychotherapy you practice, mm-hmm. which is cognitive behavioral therapy. Just mm-hmm. explain that for us.
Well, I do cognitive behavioral therapy, but not all CBT, that's what we call it, CBT therapists are the same. We all have our own worldview. So you can have a CBT therapist that has a Buddhist background. You can have a CBT therapist that has a distinctly Christian background. You can have a Christian CBT therapist who does more of Eastern religion type of CBT therapy. So just because you get a CBT therapist doesn't mean that they all have the same worldview. And cognitive behavioral therapy is about helping people understand why they're doing what they're doing and why they're feeling the way they're feeling because of their thoughts. So as a CBT therapist, I want to redirect them to, what am I thinking, my thoughts, and how can I change the way I think to help me feel better and do better? But the way I do that, I'm going to have to use truth involved in that. And the way I see truth is going to be different depending on the therapist.
So what is truth in this century?
Yes. Well, we live in a very postmodern world. And so truth in our society is often, this doesn't mean everybody thinks this way, but in our society, there's much more of a focus on experience. What I see, what I feel, what I touch, my experiences all together through my senses are my truth. So if I am in this realm over here and you're in that realm, because of my experience in this area, I might think, well, this is truth, not understanding, well, maybe that doesn't work the same way over there. But then as a postmodernist, I might think, well, that's their truth because they're over there, versus there being an absolute truth for all people.
And what's the danger of having relative truth?
Relative truth. The danger of that is that I miss out on truth, real truth, absolute truth. And so I might I might experience everything that I go through, I'm looking at my feelings. What do my feelings tell me versus what is actually true? Now, if I went before a judge and I said, Your Honor, I feel this way. I know this person is doing something bad to me, but the judge looks at the evidence and says, well, you know what? I've looked at the evidence, but because you feel that way, I'm going to side with you. We'd have a very difficult judicial system.
That's right. Justice would not be
justice served. would not be the same. And so, or a scientist who said, you know what, I think this works this way, and I feel like that's how it's going to work, but does all the science and everything to show otherwise, and said, but you know what, I'm going to disregard the science because this is how I feel it is. We'd have really bad science, but so often people make their decisions about how things are in their families, in their relationships, in their workplace, based on how they feel and not what the evidence is. So as a therapist, I try to show them maybe what the evidence is versus just how they feel.
So while feelings are important, evidence is more substantial. More from Amanda Anguish after the break. Annie was struggling with a bad back, weight gain, depression, three busy youngsters, and a husband who traveled for work. Then she joined the Choice program and learned how to cook simple, nutritious meals. Watch what happened.
I'm happy now. I don't feel like defeated or anything. I don't feel depressed. Even if my husband is away, no one's helping me, I kind of have more energy. I'm more happy with my kids. Like, I play more a lot with them. Because before, I just don't like, okay, just do whatever you do. I just sit here, just whatever. And if you need me, just call me. But now, I interact with them more. It's more easier for me to, even if I don't have coffee too, I still have that energy. I could just go all day, 12 hours a day with them. I'm good. Just 4 months. I lost 27 pounds. It was just clean eating, just more vegetables and no dairy as much as possible. I totally changed and exercise every day. And now I'm happy with the outcome, but I'm still working on more. People ask me how I exercise with my two toddlers and one baby. Infant. Well, what I do when they take a nap, because I make sure they nap like at the same time, that's the time I would have a chance to exercise. Even if you're doing laundry, you can still do at least 10 minutes exercise while doing the laundry, or 5 minutes. And I walk with them. So I go to the mall with them, not just shopping. I just go there, just walk around for a mile to 2 miles, and they get to have exercise too. My friends, they always ask me how I did it, but the only thing I say is just pray, and everything will follow. And have that mindset, and you'll be able to, because we can't do anything without Him.
That's so true. And before the break, we were talking with therapist Amanda Anguish about what is truth in the context of emotional health. Here she is with more.
Truth is not just how I feel, like I mentioned before. It's if I'm in a rational place, if I'm in a logical place, I'm going to be able to see things not just how I see them, but also how other people see them. We call this emotional intelligence, and this is often more important than just intellectual intelligence. But I'm going to be able to recognize my emotions, how they affect me in different situations, but also be able to manage those emotions rather than letting the emotions manage me. And so often in our society, we really value emotions. We say things like, follow your heart. Well, the Bible says the heart, you know, is not something that we should be following. It says sometimes it can lead us astray. So we have to think differently about our feelings than just what we're told in society. So, but it also means I have to recognize how other people around me are feeling, and then manage the relationships that I have with those people. And that's part of what I teach people, is not just to see things how they affect them, but how they affect other people, and specifically, you know, when people are having a difficult situation with another person, one of the things I tell them is I have to remind myself, sometimes when I'm having difficulties with others, they might be having difficulties with me. And so rather than just seeing how it affects me, I want to see how it affects other people too. And that opens up the space to be able to say, oh, I didn't realize that maybe we're all struggling in this, and I want to think about how it's affecting them too.
Right. It's so important to think about the other person, isn't it?
Yeah. And that's truth, is looking at the whole.
Okay, so relative truth is here, and absolute truth is
seeing the bigger picture. Right. And that's the beauty of believing in a God, you know, the God who created the universe, is recognizing that even he sees things differently, and things in our life might not be happening the way that we see them just because of how we feel, but there might be a greater purpose in those things too.
Now, in your talk here at the EQ Summit, you also mentioned that you do biblical counseling. What is that?
Well, a lot of people do biblical counseling differently. Some therapists will say, well, I'm a Christian counselor. Well, I like to think of myself as a biblical counselor. I am a Christian, but I use the Bible in my practice, and I use the Bible to show what truth is. Because the Bible says, you know, God says, my ways are not your ways, my plans are not your plans. And sometimes we see things only as how they affect us or how we experience things. And so we want to see them also how God sees them. And so that's how I use the Bible, is to show them maybe there's a bigger purpose in all this. Maybe there's something for me to learn. Maybe the pain is not just to be cured right away, but the pain is to bring me to a place of better understanding of God's will in my life. And so things like how Jacob wrestled with God, that wasn't just a momentary, I'm going to get over it, find a cure thing, but that was to bring him out of a place where he had been, you know, erroneously seeing God in his relationship with God, and now he had a greater understanding and was able to meet his brother in a different way because of that experience. So I want to help people see things in a more biblical view of pain and suffering and persecution and things like that.
So do you send people home to read the Bible? Do you do it together in the office?
It depends. It depends on the motivation that they have. Sometimes people have a hard time going home and getting into reading their Bibles. Sometimes it's just talking about stories that they already know and seeing, reframing them in a way that they go, oh, I never saw that story that way. I can see how I relate to that character in the Bible, that real person that lived before me, or even how I can see Christ, his life was, he led his life in a way that he can relate to my pain and my suffering too.
How do you approach a client that says, I'm a bad person because of what I've done?
That's a fun question to answer. I don't always sound like the nicest person when I answer it, maybe, but I believe in taking responsibility for our part in things. And sometimes when people say that, it's really because guilt has been building up inside of them for things that they've done. And I want them to be able to recognize that, yeah, we can do bad things and we can take responsibility for those things, and consequences come of those. But God always gives us an opportunity to make those wrongs right, or right as much as we possibly can. And he can restore our relationships after those things happen if we take responsibility for them. So that's one of the things that I do when somebody does that. But I also let them know that God does forgive us, and he recognizes that, you know, we don't always know what we're doing when we're doing it, but if we take responsibility for it, he'll actually give us something even greater out of it than we would have even imagined.
Just as Annie took responsibility for her health, made the changes she knew she needed, she's now better off, body, mind, and soul, than she would have ever imagined. And if you're challenged by depression, anxiety, or another disorder, don't instinctively reach for a pill. Consider counseling. Find a therapist you can work with. Be willing to open your mind to seeing things from a different perspective. Consider making the Bible your source of meditation and also your textbook for truth.
Don't let your feelings lead your life, but surrender them to truth and to reason. Remember the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. That's all from me today. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.